Hi there, and welcome to another episode of Horse Sense, a show for you, the thinking horse person. At Horse Sense, we give you practical, relevant, up-to-date, and even inspirational information that's going to enrich your horsing life. If you're a first-time listener, welcome. And if you've been here before, welcome back. It's great to have you. This show is brought to you by the Equine Care Clinic, a clinic dedicated to the care of sick or injured horses when their owners aren't able to. Check out the site at equinecareclinic.com. I'm your host, Amanda Edwards, and this week I'm talking to Sandy Simon. Sandy's an inspirational woman who's overcome her self-doubt, fear and insecurities after having children to continue her passion for horses and horse riding. Sandy's the author of A Life Worth Riding and her honest and open story about her journey to this point. It's a really good read. She's developed her confidence clinics to help other women overcome their fear, build confidence and return to confident riding. Enjoy!
How are you today?
I'm wonderful, and thank you so much for having me.
That's a real pleasure, and I know the listeners are just going to love you today, Sandy. And I hear that you are up in hot Swan Hill. How is it there today?
Yes, up in the Nelly region. It's beautiful, absolutely beautiful. Such lovely people up here. It's an absolute joy to come up here and train.
Fantastic. So, Sandy, tell the listeners a bit about you and the journey of how you got to where you are now. And I have been reading your book, and it's a really big journey. So tell us who you are.
Well, it's been a very long journey, but I was born in Heathcote in Victoria and was raised in Rochester, a very rural town. You know, where you do all the typical young kid things. And you know, my life with horses wasn't so much about anything horse training. It was more about they were our transport. So, you know, horses were just part of our lives. And my brothers kept stealing my push bike, so horses were it. So I just sort of had an upbringing with horses as everything, which was...
Yeah, and I just, when I read that, I was really struck by how you talked about horses as your freedom, because when I grew up, I would say that was exactly the same thing. For me, I used to ride my horse. We lived in Eltham, and I used to ride across to Templestowe to visit my friend and all these places. There's no way I could have got to on a bike. So it was amazing.
No, I totally agree. With that. Yeah. And, you know, most days we had, you know, two or three of us kids on the one horse, going places, and you know, we used to drag the chain along with us and get to where we were going and tether them and go and have a swim, or you know, we'd ride out to the channel or down to the river or go to the football every Saturday. I'd go and play netball and ride to netball, and so it was just a part of everyday life, which I believe has got a bit lost in today's world. Unfortunately, we're not adored that you know, good grace of being able to have that, purely because of the environment's changed so much. So it's something I cherish a lot.
I think it is, I would tend to agree with you. So you grew up in Heathcote and...
I was born in Heathcote and I grew up in Rochester.
Yeah. So then you sort of, you still had your horses and you had some children?
Yeah, it all went wayward pretty quick. Oh, that's for sure. I barely blinked, and before I knew it, I was a mother.
Yeah, and a young mum at that.
Oh, very much so. Very much so. I was a child with a child.
Yeah.
And I went through all the turmoil of, you know, how do we deal with that? And, of course, I had no age or wisdom or any logic. And so I was put into a system that was the normal back then. Actually, it was the only other option for teenage mothers was, you know, you either stayed with your family or you were sent away to a bit like an orphanage, you could say, but a home for pregnant teenagers. And they were the only options back then. And, you know, and I look back now and I only have fond memories of that place, being around so many like-minded girls. And, you know, I couldn't imagine what else would have happened. My family had actually fallen apart by that stage, so there was no security back at home, and my mum was very unwell and was dealing with the breakup of her marriage, and most of my brothers and sisters had left town, you know, out to go to work, so there was not much on offer for me to stay at home. So I was put, you know, on the advice of professionals and where I should go, and that sort of started the whole feeling of abandonment for me. And you know, and we all know that's a horrific feeling to feel as a child, and that sort of started the whole turmoil. I'm obviously falling pregnant was the beginning, but dealing with it afterwards was it was pretty horrific. If I was a bit older, I think it would have been a different story, but being so young and not understanding was very confronting.
It's very hard to comprehend what's happening, I think, at those stages. But really, you got through that. You showed amazing resilience and had your kids. You had your first two kids, and that's where I'm up to in the book, so you're going to have to take the story from there. Well, I'm a bit further along, but yeah.
Well, I often tell myself I'm a very good broodmare because I went on to have another three. so, you know, I went from probably from bad choice to bad choice. You know, I was swelling around in this whole, you know, mindset of I'm unloved, you know, I'm abandoned, I'm a victim. So, you know, my whole life was dictated by all of these terrible stories that were in my head. And I was really lacking the support and the empathy and compassion from others because I wouldn't sit still long enough and create a connection with anybody. Or I was also very busy trying to raise these children. And, you know, I got to a point where I said, you know what, I can't do this. This is just too hard. I was, you know, I was frowned upon by many, and everyone had their opinions about me. And I had no idea what was right and what was wrong and what was the truth.
Yeah.
You know, I was just trying to muddle through it. So at one stage I actually said to my mother, I can't do this anymore. And I had no idea back then, but now I do. I had severe postnatal depression.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we fostered the kids out, and then I went on to a program on how to, you know, try and deal with how I was feeling and then integrate back to the kids so I was healthier in my mind, which I did. But a lot of that was, for me at the time, you know, it was important for me to go and just play like a child. I wanted to go out to the drive-in. I wanted to, you know, go and see my friends. I wanted to be a child or a teenager. So a lot of that for me was I was allowed to kick up my heels a little bit, and that actually helped me. I didn't feel so trapped.
Yeah, and you could choose to be, you know, to step into the new space.
Yeah, and very slowly I was very bombarded, and I felt very trapped. Everyone else around me was growing and leaving school and enjoying life and going on dates, and I was at home changing nappies. So I felt very suffocated and very trapped. And you know, they say all women should love their children; they're born with a bond. And you know, I had that, but I didn't understand the depth. What I did know for sure about me was they are my children; no one else is having them.
Yeah,
that was okay to say that, but okay, I'm having them now. What, you know, what does this mean?
Yeah.
And I, you know, I went from a child into running a household. I had no idea on how that worked, and the system that you need to do and the routines that you need. I had no idea about any of that. So it was real trial and error. And I didn't grow up quickly. I would like to think I did, but I didn't. I didn't grow up quickly. I was very resistant of the position I had placed myself into, and I had placed myself in that by making choices. But again, you know, sex education wasn't out back then to, you know, to learn about your own body. You were given a book. You know, it wasn't an open conversation. So it was.
Did you get that book, Where Did I Come From?
Yes. Yes, I did. Yes, I did. And that wasn't all that helpful.
Not really.
No.
I recall just sort of some very childlike pictures and.
Yes. And of course, because I felt abandoned, I was searching for where I belonged and for love. And, you know, that was sort of the record that played in my head for a very long time. And then, of course, I became the victim. I'm like, well, poor me, look at me. And that's not healthy either. So, you know, it was a very traumatic time for me. And then we went on a bit and my brother was killed in a car accident. So that in itself, I had no understanding of grief. So you had grief on top of all the other stuff that was going on in my head, and I really started to spiral out of control. And I'm very lucky that I'm not an addictive type person, because I could have picked up on alcohol or drugs or, you know, gone that route. But, you know, we were raised, you know, never to look at that. And it was also an era where you didn't see it a lot. So I was very lucky that I didn't get dragged that way, because I could have quite easily if it was around me. I was so vulnerable.
Yeah.
So, and
that
also,
need to be accepted and loved and cared
absolutely,
for.
Absolutely.
It does take a lot of kids.
Oh, and you see, you know, young girls out there now going, you can see it, and it's awful, because it does push you to make the wrong choices for the wrong reasons, but at the time you think they're right. So, you know, I went on and I was engaged and met a lovely man and got engaged, and we were engaged for years. And he was wonderful with the kids. And again, I ended up falling, you know, years down the track, I fell pregnant again. And as soon as that happened, that was it. It was over. He'd given that up and walked away from me. So there I was, sitting back in exactly the same position. Yeah. So, you know, the last thing I needed was confirmation. And that's what I got. So, you know, the whole turmoil came back again. So what little road forward I was making was just knocked out from underneath me. And, you know, and at that stage I was working two jobs to try and raise the kids and, you know, trying to manage a relationship. And, you know, and of course I was blindsided big time, and I thought the relationship was very healthy. And but unfortunately, no. So I was just thrown back in the deep end again. And that set me back again, because I'd worked fairly hard to try and get the right path in the right direction and do the right thing by the kids. And at that stage, I'd had the kids under control and was doing well at school. And, you know, I thought everything was ticking along. So that one really blindsided me. And that's where my anger started. You know, I walked away from that thinking, well, to hell with the world. I've had enough of this. How many times do I have to go through this? So,
And that, your story is unfortunately very true for many people. So there's lots of people. I can think of two or three friends who have had a similar story. So it's tough. It's really tough being a single mum who have no support.
No, I totally agree. Totally. I'm in awe of the single mums out there. And the, you know, the role that they have to be mum and dad and caretaker and, you know, work.
Provider and
yeah, they've everything. And it's, you know, I have such admiration for them all. And I did it for a very, very long time. And, you know, like I said, at the time I was going through such turmoil, but I look back now and I just thank God I went through it. It's created such qualities in me that are, you know, I really like.
Yeah, and resilient.
Oh, yeah, very resilient.
Yeah, you know, you are, not only did you survive it, but you've thrived after it.
Absolutely.
And you've taken what you've learnt and applied it, and look at how many people you help now.
Oh, absolutely. It's
extraordinary.
It's given me, and I do, I really thank God that I went through it all. Now, you know, in my life for the last 20 years, I look at, and work with women, and I look at them and I can see the pain and feel the pain, and I actually understand it. I know exactly what it feels like. I know what it's like to be lost. No one needs to remind me of that. I've got that one. So you know, it's one of the greatest gifts I was ever given. Why was I chosen to go that path? I don't know. You know, it's just it's my story, and it's a story I'm very proud of, which is why I wrote the book. Everybody needs to know that they're not lost, and there is help out there. They've just got to reach out. And it's, you know, the world's changed now. Obviously, there's support and understanding of it all. But back then, you know, even when my father left my mother, you never spoke about that. You know, that was a taboo thing. And and we've been educated more, and there's so much more understanding of that now that people, you know, barely see it on the radar. So it's changed and evolved. Now, if the same thing happened to me now, it'd be a whole different story, whole different story. So, you know, I'm really glad that we've evolved in the area of caring for women in that way.
Yeah. Most so certainly. Tell me, how did you get from that very lost space after he left to where you are now, which is a pretty happy place by all accounts and by looking at it?
Yes, it certainly is. Well, I moved town to get a fresh start and took the kids with me and had my third son, my third child, second son, and I just put my head down and I used my anger to my benefit. I thought I'm not looking for anything. I just need to raise these kids. I just need to get hard at work. And I sort of straightened myself up a bit. And unfortunately, the anger, as we all know, that becomes toxic. And, you know, then comes a resentment and so on. And I found when I decided that I just need to walk forward and to hell with everyone else was my attitude, that I was riddled with guilt and shame. And I had to work very hard to get my head around that. You know, why did I feel so shameful and so vulnerable still? But I used my anger. My anger sort of gave me a driving force for a while.
Actually, I was at a conference the last couple of days, an aged care conference, and Brian Lipman, who set up Winteringham, which is a niche aged care facility for homeless people, and he did that out of anger at the system, and he says that anger gets a bad rap, anger is only bad when it's twisted towards yourself or others, but anger as a driving force is a powerful motivator. And I was like, that actually is very interesting, and for me it rang true too, because sometimes I've got mad at something and I've created something amazing. Sometimes I got mad at something and done something terrible.
Absolutely. And anger, you've got to be, you know, I had to be very careful that I didn't become resentful or vindictive or toxic. But, you know, I was that angry, I got into the mindset of, well, to hell with you all, I'll just get successful. You know,
What was your work at that stage? What were you doing?
I've always been, back then, the easiest roles for me to take on, employment was being a barmaid, because I could have the kids at home in bed with a sitter and go to work. And then once they hit school, I got into being a medical receptionist.
Yeah.
And then I was still barmaid, so at night.
Yeah, and do you not think that gives you an amazing ability to build rapport with people?
Oh, hell yeah. Hell yeah. I fell in love with all the elderly men. They were beautiful. Their stories were just amazing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And also they gave me comfort, because there was no ulterior motive. You know, the young guys at the pub drinking, you know, they had ulterior motives, but I found real solace in the elderly, and I still do. But since I was a little girl, I've always loved sitting with the elderly and listening, always. Yeah. So I enjoyed that a lot.
Cool. Yeah. So fast forward, and you've raising the kids in a new town. And so where were horses in all of this?
They were spasmodic, very spasmodic. Yep. I always had one sitting in the paddock somewhere. you know, as I got heavy with work and, you know, changed towns and moved around a bit, I found them hard to maintain. But there was always some horse somewhere that I was working with, or I was helping someone's kids to ride, or so I always had my finger on the pulse with horses. And most of the time I did own one. And at that stage it was usually a pony for the kids, but I did try. I had a passion for showing back then and a bit of dressage. So I did try to keep my, you know, toe in the pool type of thing. But, you know, it was a constant juggle with finances, time and energy, you know, to keep that going. But most of the time I did have some association or relationship with a horse.
That's it's really, it is quite hard, but did you find at those times that the horse that you had or that connection just centered you and grounded you a bit? I asked that question because that's sort of what I found.
I think horses throughout my whole life have been my, they've always soothed my soul and given me that time out, which is why I couldn't let the connection go. I had to at some stage, you know, throughout the week, I had to go and reconnect with the horse and just sit quietly and or share the kids, you know, the kids would go ride. And so I had to keep the connection. It was sort of like a cleansing every time I went near the horse. I had a bit of a cleanse, and the horse would put me in the place of now and not let me worry about, you know, yesterday or tomorrow. And I think that kept me, that was the only part that kept me centered. And, you know, I said before there was no support, no people and no empathy or compassion that were consistent. The horses remained consistent. And, you know, I used to tell all my stuff to the horse.
Yes. And there is something very soothing about that. I like the way you describe soothing.
Yeah.
I often go out in the paddock and feel soothed and calmed.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's really quite a powerful. I asked that question because I felt like there would always be a horse in there somewhere.
Yeah.
So tell me, then you go forward again, so the next sort of part of your life. When did you meet David?
Well, that's when I'd moved town, and it was, you know, a fair while. I was on my own through the third pregnancy, basically, and I had him on my own. And, you know, I worked late in pregnancy and then got home, went straight back to work, in case of have to, not want to. And, you know, a couple of months had gone past, and I just had my head down and ring up, going hard, trying to keep the household running and stuff and keep the kids at school. And, you know, it was all very costly. And I got asked to go out to see a band. One of my neighbours had seen that I was, you know, struggling and you know, a bit of postnatal depression and, you know, that sort of thing. And I went, you know what, I reckon I think I need to. So off I went and went out to see Joe Camilleri, actually, in Geelong, and hadn't been out for a fair while. And I had sort of known a few of the local people, but, you know, I never went out or went to the pub or anything, but I did, you know, I knew the local hairdresser, I knew the hairdresser's boyfriend, you know, that sort of thing. So there was a group of people that I went out with, and yeah, that's where I met David. We were out, and he was working up in the Northern Territory. He was a head stockman, and he was home on you know, what they call their wet months. And yeah, he was there, and I was there, and that was it. That was it. It was all over.
So all your good intentions of staying single, yes, and hating the world just dissolved right on that dance floor in front of old Joe Camilleri.
Yeah, that was it. Yeah, and of course I walked very tenderly with it, and David's just such a humble man and still is, and he just knew a way just to quietly walk beside me and let me figure it out, and never challenged me and never pushed me. And he was very gentle, very, very gentle. And one of the reasons why I stayed committed, as much as it was hard for me, and we dated solidly for the first year, is because he just walked in and loved those children like I'd never seen from their own father. You know, he just walked in and just adored those children. And I thought to myself, now that's a good person. That is a good person. So I opened up
I mean, I don't know him, but you look at David and he does look like a person with a great heart.
Oh, he does. It's huge.
And huge. You can see exactly what you're describing. What what an absolute blessing for you.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I put him through turmoil for the first while because I, you know, the record in my mind is any moment now he's going to go. Any moment now he's going to go. So I even started to push. You know, I kept creating arguments and pushing him, saying, well, then go. And I was trying to get him to prove me right.
And isn't that funny? Because, you know, what you focus on is actually, if you've got that story in your head, that's actually ending, it ends up being you actually drive towards it.
Well, you create it. You actually create it.
Without even consciously knowing you do it.
Yeah. I totally agree.
It's a strange and exasperating human thing.
I totally agree. But I, you know, at that stage, I knew no different.
So if you looked back at yourself now as an outsider, you'd go, what are you doing, you crazy person?
You idiot. But I knew no difference.
You don't even know you're doing it, though.
No, of course not.
You wouldn't have known you were doing that.
But it's a bit, you know, it's a bit like the woman that has a husband that's, you know, runs off and has an affair. You have an infidelity issue and meet someone else. And I hold them accountable. They want to see that they can trust them, and they put a radar on it, and they start punishing the next person for the last relationship, and until it's healed, you know, that's what happens. But I actually knew no different. I thought, well, this is going to crash and burn.
This is how it goes.
Yeah. And my mind was, well, come on, hurry up and do it.
You know? Get over it, done with it.
Yep, hurry up, let's get this done. And thank God for David. He's so calm and, you know, relaxed. That he just kept staying consistent, just continually stayed consistent and calm and gentle. And the other side to David too is he's very passionate and very driven, and he's heading in a direction, and I found that very sexy. I'm like, this man really knows where he's going, and I want to walk along this journey and watch. You know, I'd never met a man that was so driven. You know, he was just, you know, look out of my way, that's where I'm going. And from the moment I've met him, he has been so hardly driven to be the best horseman he can be. You know, back then horsemanship wasn't heard of or discussed.
Yeah.
But he had this just huge flame inside of him that just didn't stop. And he's still like that today. That has never shifted, ever.
And he's an amazing horseman.
Yes. And if you told him that, he would say, no, I've still got a lot to learn.
Which is the absolute epitome of an amazing horseman.
Yeah. Yep. He said he's going to die learning, and he still doesn't know enough. And he's got futurity horses now. And when he rides them, he'll come up and he'll say, I learnt something today. I'm like, how much more brain space do you have? Yeah. And he's constantly at it, constantly striving. It's never shifted in him.
That's brilliant. And so you're not too shabby a horse person yourself.
thanks.
Your journey alongside that has been quite powerful as well. And so what I'm interested in is, how did you sort of, you've met David, eventually you've married and had two more children, and then along this way you've developed the confidence clinics,
which I think
is absolutely brilliant.
Well, thank you. I actually didn't develop them. They developed themselves. I just went along for the ride. You know, that's when we go into the whole new era of me as a woman. I was, you know, busy eventually with five children, and the last one was Riley, who's now 20, was a traumatic birth, you know, early prem, and that really took a toll on my confidence. And I had lost a bit with the horses after each birth, but as I got a bit older and wiser and smarter and more in tune with how I felt, the bigger impact it had. So, you know, unfortunately at the time, which is fortunate now, of course, we had a horse training business, and Dave was the business. I just ran it. So I was around horses every day. So I was confronted with my fears every day. And, you know, I've always had good horses. I've been blessed, you know, in that manner. And I only own one at a time. I don't care for any more. And it got that bad that I couldn't even walk out of the house. I just got so petrified. And it was all about the what if, and it was the fear of, if something happens to me, what's going to happen? I've got all these children, I've got this business, I've got this husband, you know, what? I don't know how anything is going to continue on if something happens to me. And it was that fear of what if that just it just overwhelmed me, and it really crippled me emotionally. And you know, I would completely convince myself before I got out of bed I was going to go for a ride. You know, my mind chatter was, I'm going to get up, I'm going to wear my blue breeches today, and I'm going to go out at 10 o'clock. And so I had it all pre-planned, and then I'd get up and walk around, do a few things, take the kids to school, and then I'd just, no, actually, I need to go and pay a bill, or actually, I need to go feed the dogs, or, you know, and I just put excuse after excuse after excuse. Next thing you know, it's 6 o'clock at night, and you're cooking dinner. And no horse was touched, and I did that for a long time. Long time until I thought, what the hell is this about? And I started looking at it. The more I looked at it, the worse I got. Because there was no one around at that stage to say, you know what, this is really normal. You know, yeah. No one had spoken about that. And if you said you were fearful back then, and we're talking, you know, 25 years ago, 30 years ago when it started, that was a taboo subject. You didn't say that. You just shut up and got on.
You got on and you...
faked it.
Rode.
Yeah, you faked
it. And if you fell off, you got back on and you rode.
Yep, yep. And the attitude back then is, you got a horse, you own it, ride it.
Yes, you must ride it, of course, too. You must ride it, can't just be with it.
Yep, that's exactly right. So, you know, it was through exploring that. One day David came in and I was sitting on the kitchen floor and I was absolutely sobbing. I couldn't take it anymore. And he sat down beside me and he said, you know, what's going on? And I said, you know, I don't know. And he said, what is it that you want? And I looked at him, I said, and that's the scary part. Honey, I've got no idea. I had completely lost myself in parenting and business and giving to everybody else that I ended up in just a washed out dishcloth sitting on the floor. And any thought of doing anything outside of my comfort zone was crippling, absolutely crippling. So, you know, he sort of sat beside me and said, righto, come on, we're going to figure this out. And it took us years to figure it out. But he kept asking me questions, you know, when I was around the horse and only ever around my own horse. But he'd always ask me questions of, well, what frightens you the most? And, you know, I actually would have said in the beginning, what frightens me the most is falling off. Which is what everyone's fear is. But I looked deeper and thought, you know what, it's not just falling off. It's being hurt. And being hurt can happen on the ground. You know, being hurt can be riding them both. And we started to look into, you know, what can we do about lowering the amount of danger? And we started to slowly create a system just for me, just so I could ride. And we worked with it and developed it and worked with it and developed it. And a lot of time I'd go off my own and think, I need to play with this and think about it and try it and then come back and check in with him. And, you know, we did that over years. And it sort of got to the point when we were at clinics and I would ride at his clinics or take my horse to his clinics. I had a Grand Prix dressage horse back in those days. And we'd take my horse in case other people wanted to have a ride. And I'd end up with more women sitting in the corner with me than out there riding with him. And, you know, Dave's eventually going, what's going on, girls?
Hang on a minute.
Yeah, what the hell? And all the girls would say, I'm really frightened. And you know, they'd come over to me and say, what are you doing sitting there? I'm saying, I'm just quietly petrified. And next thing I know, I've got them all sitting with me, wanting to talk to me about it because I understood it. And of course, that's how it sort of started.
It's grown into because I think what you inadvertently did through your own journey has tapped into something I can completely understand, you know, because what happens is you have children and exactly what you say happens. But I had a 15-year space and then my horse died, the one that I trusted.
Yeah,
and it was incredibly harder. It was just so incredibly hard to get on another horse and learn, and I felt like I couldn't ride anymore and all of those things, and it was really terrifying. And I would have loved something like you know, what you offer now just kind of fast tracks that in a way, doesn't it, now? Because applying their system, you give them a tool bag to go out with to say, here's some tools to help you with those fears.
Absolutely. But also the other part to that was that I discovered was that it's not all about the horse. Why had I lost myself? You know, how did that happen? Where did I disappear to? And I, you know, I was treated right, a great marriage, great husband, but it was about giving so much that I failed to take. And, you know, I that was the biggest part for me was, well, where on earth did you go? Where are you? So I had to work, and I still do today, I work really, really hard on self-development and understanding how that happened and what that was about and why that happened. And so I think the biggest component of being a fearful rider now is that we lose trust in ourselves. And we haven't been around horses all our lives as women and learnt nothing. Of course, we've created ability upon ability upon ability, but the higher the fear, the bigger the disconnect to our ability. So
I think that's an absolute truth. Yeah. It's been a truism for me, and I'm obviously it's a truism for many other women as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we just lose that connection to what we already innately know around a horse, and we don't trust ourselves. So it's about, you know, coming along to the clinics with me. I sit and talk. We sit all morning and we talk. And I engage with them and ask them who they are and what their journey is. And that's the other part. I don't believe women are heard enough. You know,
no, well, we're too busy running, doing,
right.
and
that's
doing.
Right. Yeah, and
not being.
We need to sit and speak our truth and say, you know what, this is petrifying, but I'm so passionate and I really want it, but this is petrifying. And when they speak their truth, it's healing for them. They engage that others are feeling exactly the same way, so they don't feel so alone. Mm-hmm. And then we offer them the support, not only in the horse training, but with the understanding that they're okay.
Yeah,
you know, it's okay to feel like this. You don't have to ride your horse to train it.
And yes, that's a powerful piece too. So you can get your sort of confidence back a bit on the ground before you even have to get on.
Exactly. And if you don't want to get on, I honour that with them. I say, great choice. You know, not only have you been out of the saddle, but your horse hasn't been ridden. You know, you both need time to find your mojo together and work it out together, and all of the ground skills that I've developed were to assist me to ride a safer horse. You know, I wasn't using black to have white. I was, everything that I've done on the ground is about me getting on. So
yeah, and making it quieter and safer.
Yeah, and safer. And so when they go out and sit at the clinics and actually pour it out, we see a lot of tears. A hell of a lot of tears, because they have such relief. Like, oh, thank God I'm not the only one. I felt so alone and no one else gets this. And I just get told to shut up and ride it. And I'm busy and the pressure's on. I've got kids and blah, blah, blah. And I allow them just to sit quietly and enjoy their horse and be safe. And there's no expectation as well. So you remove that and they just tick along and find their ability.
Yeah, that's a beautiful, beautiful, powerful thing.
Yeah, and that's
and
what
I think.
That's
then it has
need.
This translation back to, it has a translation back into life.
Totally, totally. So, and a lot of women have come back to me after the clinics and said, and they have told me, I've used these tools in my life, and I'm so much more calmer and so much more peaceful and. I'm achieving a lot more, and I now understand a lot of what's going on in my life rather than being misunderstood. So the feedback that comes back is if you shift how you think internally, you shift what happens around you.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, we create that place for them to be their own truth and then allow the horse to do the healing throughout the rest of the clinic in the training. So it's a great blend.
It's absolutely brilliant, actually.
Thank you.
Well, because it's empowering. It's very empowering, and that takes people out of being a victim and being angry and resentful. It empowers them.
I totally agree. And, you know, one of the greatest things, you know, I said before, my past has given me such great qualities. my past, because I had no one ever sit with me and say, what's going on? What can we do for you consistently? I had a little bit of it, but consistently, every single time I sit with a woman, I sit and think to myself, I'm going to listen to you.
Yeah.
I'm going to give you the space to allow you to say whatever you want. And I'm going to protect that and look after it because you deserve that. And that I took from my past.
And that's what a great thing to be able to do. So, yeah, I can see where you've taken that. Because the other thing you're doing is passing on the gift of resilience to other women.
Oh, totally, totally. I keep saying to them all, if I can do this stuff, you can too.
And you do it in a really fun way. I've watched you talk this, and it's not all like deep and meaningful. It's
fun
and light and
fun.
Let's just have a really get back to our play. And it's really,
I
think
joy.
It has so many elements of just greatness that I'm really impressed by it. So what would you say, because we do have to come to a close shortly, what would you say to women to say, what are the like three key things or one or two key things that they can do when they look out that window or they go to the adjustment property or whatever and look at that horse and they're terrified but they want to get on, where do they start?
Well, I think the first key ingredient would be trust yourself.
Yep.
Believe in yourself and know that even if it's just going over and smelling them for that day, that is enough. It's not about, you don't have to set an agenda and accomplish an agenda. You need to get on your own journey with this. I think the second part would be find a training system that fits you, not everybody else. Just because, you know, you're at an adjustment centre that's totally one way doesn't mean you can be the other. You don't have to fit into a mould. You can create your own.
Yep.
And you've got to create your own based off who you are and how you feel and how, you know, what are your fear levels exactly, what do you need? And it's not about going out and spending money and joining a club or buying in and, you know, and doing a cult. It's about find what fits. And when I say what fits, it feels good in your soul, that's it. That's all you need to know.
And it works for you, then do it. Yeah.
Yeah. And the third part would be the greatest advice I can give anybody is that you are enough. Just as you stand there today, you're enough.
Oh, I just got goosebumps.
Yeah.
That is so true. And I think that's a message, you know, before this interview started, Sandy and I were having a little chat getting our sound check, and I was one of those things that you said then was just to, that we've disconnected from our ability to ride, be with horses, but also I think we've disconnected, it's in the busy that we've got going now, it's very easy to disconnect from people and feel very lonely in a very busy, busy world. So I think that you are enough is a very powerful message.
Yeah, and we all need to believe it.
Well, I have to say, Sandy, this has been a most inspiring and amazing talk, and I know the listeners out there are going to love this.
Thanks.
You are actually, so far, and they're spread wide and far, I might say, all over the world, in fact.
Yeah.
And what's really common is that they are mostly women and mostly over 40s and love horses. So, and always, you know, this show is called Horse Sense, and it's for the thinking horse person, but it's really the reflective horse person that really wants to keep, like David and yourself, just keep learning. I really want to thank you so much for sharing your message with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's been an absolute pleasure, and I hope you have a great clinic out there at Swan Hill.
We will,
and we will talk again one day. Thank you.
I look forward to it. Thank you.
So what do you think? Inspirational, right? My top three takeaways from today are: number one, a systematic approach of small steps for both you and the horse is going to get you there. It is surmountable. You can do this. Number two, we're all so much more courageous and capable than we imagine, and it's just a matter of tapping into that. And number three, never forget you're worth it. You can find more information on Sandy's website at sandysimons.com.au, and there's links to Sandy's site at the Horse Sense Show website in the show notes. Pop over and leave a comment. I love that. So what did you find most interesting or confronting about that chat? Was there anything there for you? We want to hear from you. And don't forget to support the sponsorship of this show by checking out the Equine Care Clinic website at equinecareclinic.com for the latest on first response workshop dates, access to all the products we use at the clinic, and heaps of credible information to keep your horse happy and healthy. Like the Equine Care Clinic on Facebook for more great horse tips too. Thanks also to Angus Strachan for production, and until next time, may your horsing be great horsing. And goodbye!